Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this New Year's Eve, we are continuing the retrospective of programs from Background Briefing from the fall and winter. And given that the year was dominated by the events at Charlottesville and the emergence of neo-Nazis and white supremacists from the shadows brought out by Donald Trump, we will begin with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, Professor of History and Italian Studies at New York University, talking about the consequences of hate speech. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. And she has an article at CNN, Mail Bombs, Hate Speech Can Have Consequences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Thank you so much.
And Ruth, before we get to your article, did you catch the piece in the New York Times a couple of days ago by Alexander Stiller, the Italian scholar? I imagine your colleagues. What did you think of it? Because I think it was very thoughtful and quite subtle, but it did sort of resonate about what's happening now.
Yes, that when dictators are threatened, they will, or want to be dictators, more to the point, they will stop at nothing, even murder, to silence their critics. This article was about Mussolini, who was not yet dictator. He was a president, prime minister in a democracy, and he had his fiercest critic, the head of the Socialist Party, Matteotti was his last name, murdered. And the New York Times article was speaking with about it in reference to the Khashoggi killing. I had actually done an article some months ago on the same subject of the Matteotti killing for the Washington Post, talking about how Mussolini killed Matteotti to avoid being investigated by, you know, prosecutors. So there are many, many parallels between what Mussolini did when he was trying to escape prosecution and escape blame when he was not yet a dictator that we can learn from.
Well, it's not an exact example, but it does have some resonance in the sense that just recently in your city, Manhattan, at the Republican Club, they hosted the head of the Proud Boys. And the event was the celebration of the assassination by samurai sword of the head of the Japanese Socialist Party in the 1960s. And the head of the Proud Boys, McGinnis, showed up with a samurai sword. And then after he gave his speech to the New York Republicans, it is the headquarters of the New York Republican Party, the Metropolitan Republican Club, the Proud Boys went outside and beat up some Antifa protesters. So I know it's not on the level of what we're talking about happened in the 1920s in Italy, but there are some similarities, aren't there?
There are. And one of the main dynamics that helps authoritarian rulers is to create a situation of extreme polarization in society where the two sides can't talk to each other, where there's a lot of violence, where there's a lot of uncertainty about what truth is. And all of this helps the leader on the rise because people look to him to come in as a strong force to calm things down, or he's able to act forcefully, sometimes with martial law or rule by decree, in order to, quote, restore order. The trick is that often it's the same people who want to restore order who have created the violence.
Yeah, that's the old arsonist is the fire brigade, right? So, but in your article, you really go back into Trump's recent history, both on the campaign and in his presidency. And when you think back at some of the stuff you mentioned, for example, when he talked about Second Amendment people acting against Clinton, There was no doubt what he was doing there, and more recently, of course, exalting Gianforte for body slamming a Guardian reporter who was subsequently beaten up. And he's beaten up so savagely his glasses were broken, and Gianforte pled guilty and had to pay a fine. There's no point in even giving our audience any more examples, because we've been watching this from day one. This is an extraordinary situation to have a president. The thing that most offended me, by the way, Ruth, it just happened a couple of days ago when he complained about how inept the Saudis were. He said they had a bad concept in murdering and decapitating in Khashoggi. It was a bad concept, and yes, that it was a terrible cover-up. He was more or less saying, you know, I would have done it better, and, you know, he wasn't complaining about it as a gross violation of human rights happening in a consulate, for God's sake, in a foreign country, but it was mostly a complaint about how they didn't do a good job.
No, and that's actually, I'm writing a book on strongmen, and I'm doing a deep dive into the personalities and the rise of a lot of these rulers. And one thing they have in common is that they are amoral. They believe that you have to do what you need to do to get ahead, and they have disdain for people who bungle it. Not that they tried, but that they failed. In fact, I was writing right now on Francisco Franco, who used the civil war to emerge as a dictator. And I just this morning, I found a quote from him saying that he was upset with a fellow military officer who was planning a coup, not because he tried to overthrow the government, but because he failed. So there's a certain strongman mentality that Trump shares 100%, unfortunately, that is more upset at things being covered up badly than at the crimes themselves.
And again, I'm speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. And she has an article at CNN, Mail Bombs, Hate Speech Can Have Consequences. So let's talk a bit about where we are now, because even since you wrote the article, Ruth, there have been two more mail bombs show up, one at a restaurant owned by Robert De Niro in Tribeca, the Tribeca Grill, and the bomb was removed by the New York bomb squad early this morning. And then Joe Biden, also the same package addressed to him, was intercepted. And the reason, I think, the De Niro's restaurant, the security person noticed that he'd seen pictures of the bubble wrap envelope that the bomb came into, all these other prominent Democrats, including two former U.S. presidents, he noticed them and therefore called the police. So if he would have opened them, there would have probably been an explosion. So this is a very serious matter. And I'm astounded at the behavior of Trump. He's not even called Obama, Hillary, or any of these people, particularly the two former presidents, to console them, you know, about what's happened. That's what presidents normally do. I'm just, you know, do you feel like we're all in the twilight zone here, that the rules of the whole rule book of the behavior of American leadership has just been thrown out?
Unfortunately, I don't feel we're in the twilight zone, because it's true that the Democratic leader playbook has been thrown out, but the authoritarian playbook is being used. And if you know that playbook, you are able to find almost nothing he does surprising. And he's not going to send them a condolence note or call. He, in fact, has doubled down on his attacks against the press, even though the press was one of the targets. He's been, if anything, more adamant about even retweeting recently insinuations that these were fake bombs and fake news, which is a whole other level of seriousness.
That's what the right wing media and Fox and Breitbart and
that's right.
and Limbaugh, they're pushing that meme that this was a Democratic false flag operation. So he's even feeding that monstrosity.
Yeah, and what's going on now is the classic terrorist attack strategy where you have simultaneous attempts at violence spread out over, you know, a large area in order to make it seem as though this terrorism is frightening to people because of its randomness. And here we have a coordinated high-density attack strategy. And this is, you know, the aim of terrorists is to destabilize society. And the right has often done this ahead of an important political event that is part of the democratic playbook, i.e. elections. So this has everything to do with the midterm elections coming up and very soon. But another point, which is the bigger picture, is we have all these democratic politicians. We have CNN, which is viewed as liberal, long his target, and we have George Soros. The presence of Soros, as I wrote in my article, means that this is also a sign that the global right has a foothold in America. And you have politicians such as Steve King of Iowa who have made themselves liaisons between the American racist right and Putin and Geert Wilders, the very, you know, dangerous right in Europe, and including George Soros, who's been, you know, a target of the right for, again, in Europe and here, one of their top enemies, means that it's not just a national anti-democratic party attack. There's something bigger going on.
And indeed, Orbán in Hungary is taking that country into an authoritarian direction. He's just succeeded in shutting down the university that George Soros underwrote in Hungary. And let me just quickly ask you, though, about this, because back to what you were saying a second ago. You're talking about provocation before elections. That's the Reichstag fire, isn't it? Isn't that the best example?
There is that. There's also the fact that Vladimir Putin, who Trump so admires, when he was trying but didn't have much success ahead to become president of Russia in 1999, there were bombings of apartment buildings in Moscow that killed 200 people, terrorist activities. And that was a causal event that allowed him, it also had to do with the Chechen War, he was able to become president. And so many people look back at those destabilizing bombings as a turning point in Putin's political fortunes. Basically, a lot of historians and analysts say he wasn't really going anywhere before the bombings. And after, he was able to triumph. It's a bit more complicated than that, but that's another example. And in the history of authoritarian rulers, there's a lot of, some people call it luck. Some people call it fortuitous events that they may or may not have had something to do with. But there's a lot of cases of destabilizing actions that help them rather than harm them.
So, but, you know, I remember when Trump first came on the scene in the campaign, the Huffington Post decided not to cover him. You know, he got $5.2 billion worth of free advertising from the mainstream press, who couldn't get enough of him. And they rather bravely, but rather, you know, futilely, decided not to cover him. And after a while, they had to cover him. So how do you not fall into the trap that you just described?
Well, there's no one answer. I think some of the things that people do, and this is not TV, but Daniel Dale of the Toronto Star has been stalwart in pointing out, adding up, tallying Trump's lies. And you can never read an article by Daniel Dale, who is he covers Trump, without even on his rallies, he includes the lies right there in the coverage. It's harder for TV, but, you know, and there's a debate whether we should cover rallies or not. They're becoming very, very dangerous for journalists in them. And there's also an argument to make, like I study newsreels of rallies for Hitler and Mussolini, and if I didn't have those as a historical record, we would be losing something. On the other hand, there have been suggestions that there's just one, you send one news organization to cover it and not all of them. So we're still, America's become a laboratory for how to deal with hate speech and how to deal with a president who is supporting hate speech. And so we're kind of trying to figure it out in real time.
Right.
And often perhaps not having the right instincts.
So it's not just supporting hate speech, he's propagating it. But just in the last couple of minutes, Ruth, is this going to work against him? I just keep, you know, there was a historian, Meacham, wrote a book invoking our better angels. Our better angels will better show up within, we've only got about 2 weeks for them to show up, right? Less than 2 weeks. So the question being, is this going to backfire on him?
No, it's not going to backfire on him. It's when you have this dynamic of these kind of charismatic leaders, it's things that most of us would think that would be the political death of them. They just shrug it off. And already his reaction to the Khashoggi killing, again, that's for his public, everything he's doing is welcomed. And everything he's saying is welcomed. And the problem is the Democratic Party machine doesn't seem to be allowing enough real challengers to come forth. And this is really a problem for 2020. It's too late for the midterms.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. And she has an article at CNN, Mail Bombs, Hate Speech Can Have Consequences. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and filmmaker and author of Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. And that was Ruth Ben-Ghiat from October of 2018. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into another important issue that we covered in 2018, and that is the growing gap of inequality between the super rich and the rest of us.
Well, I'm going to tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidi-bidi-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bidi-bidi-rich, idle-diddle-diddle-diddle-man, I'd...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and co-edits inequality.org. He's the author of Born on Third Base, a 1%er makes the case for tackling inequality, and Is Inequality in America Irreversible? And he is the co-author of the new report at inequality.org, Billionaire Bonanza 2018, The Role of Dynastic Wealth. And his latest article at The Guardian is The Wealth of America's Three Richest Families Grew by 6,000% since 1982. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chuck Collins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Chuck. And I must say, your piece at The Guardian, it's just shocking in terms of the extraordinary growth in wealth of the three richest families in the United States, the Waltons of Walmart, the Mars Candy family, and the Koch brothers. These three families own a combined fortune of $348.7 billion, which is 4 million times the median wealth of a U.S. family. And since 1982, these three families have seen their wealth increase nearly 6,000%. Meanwhile, the median household wealth went down by 3% over the same period. And in terms of the Waltons, their dynastic wealth grew from $690 million in 1982 to $169.7 billion in 2018, a mind-numbing increase of more than 9,000%. So this is enough, Chuck, to make you want to man the barricades and take out the pitchforks, you know?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we tend to focus on the wealth of the very top, you know, the sort of Jeff Bezos and the Warren Buffett and Bill Gates story, which is important. But what we're looking at here is how families not just preserve their wealth over generations, but actually sort of expand it. And, you know, it's these wealth dynasties are kind of a symptom that something's broken. That the whole idea of a sort of democratic, self-governing society is people grow wealth, but as the old adage says, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. So the idea is that wealth left to its own disperses over time. It gets taxed, it gets given to charity, and it does get passed on to, you know, dozens of grandchildren. And so the wealth disperses. In this case, we're looking at second, third, and fourth generation families that are amassing more and more wealth, and that is troublesome.
So, unfortunately, it would seem that there's too much attention paid to the wealthiest among the wealthiest, particularly Bezos and Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and also Bloomberg, George Soros, and Tom Steyer. All of them are active in charity. Many of them, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, are giving away almost all of their money to charity. And, of course, we know how much attention George Soros gets, as though he's the eminence grise of left-wing politics in this country, in spite of the fact that, just to give you an idea of how little influence Soros has, he was furiously lobbying Barack Obama when he first came into office not to buy into the Geithner Republican Wall Street solution at the top. And he had an alternative plan, and of course Obama did not listen to him and instead listened to the Republican Secretary of the Treasury instead. So that's just a way to illustrate this absurd idea that these guys are all pulling the strings. But the truth of the matter is, from what I can get from your article and also this new study by Benjamin Page, Jason Seawright, and Matthew Lacombe out of Northwestern University, is that the people that you mentioned in your article, the three families, the Mars, the Kochs, and the Waltons, they're the ones that are operating a stealth program to really change the laws to their benefit. And yet they don't get the same kind of attention that the other more humane and generous billionaires get.
That's right. They have somehow figured out how to fly below the radar, but I think what we know is they are very active in public policy. They're very active in lobbying for tax policies like eliminating the estate tax, the inheritance tax. And they probably, well, we know they're aggressive users of wealth hiding techniques, or what I would call dynasty protection measures. You know, they're hiring, you know, armies of lawyers, tax accountants, wealth managers. They have family offices that are devoted to sort of figuring out ways to work the loopholes, you know, lobby to create more loopholes and pass wealth on. And this is the wealth that we know about. I think there's vast trillions of dollars of hidden wealth that is moving around and that isn't even being measured for the purposes of taxation. So these are families that are, let's say, they're arresting the natural process of wealth dispersion, and they're figuring out how to build dynasties that will probably be here, you know, three more generations forward. We're still going to be hearing about Marses and Waltons and Kochs because they're going to continue to have a huge amount of power and wealth.
But we hear about the Fords, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, mostly in terms of their foundations that do remarkable work, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Carnegie Foundations and the Endowment for Peace, etc. These big families like the Kochs, the Waltons, and the Mars family.
The Marses.
Yeah, sorry. The
Maybe
Mars.
It's because it's Halloween and you're thinking of all those Mars candy bars.
The Mars family, they're not going to be remembered for anything but greed and the accumulation of wealth. They're not... there's no incentive anymore for them to create these kind of foundations that live on to do charitable work like Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie.
No, you know, and this is a really big, important point coming out of the first Gilded Age a century ago, is people were very worried about, do these concentrations of wealth and power, will this upset our fragile self-governing democracy? And, you know, people put in place the inheritance tax and the progressive income tax. And that really did have the effect of slowing the concentration of wealth and encouraging people to give to charity. And then you had people like Andrew Carnegie who said, you know, I'm not going to pass on wealth to my children. I'd rather pass on a curse. You know, he gave, you know, an incredible amount of almost all of his wealth to knowledge institutions, building libraries and research institutions. So you don't hear, there are no members of the Carnegie family on the Forbes 400 list, you know, three generations later, nor Ford, the Ford family, you know, even though they're wealthy at the time, there's no, you know, dynastic billion-dollar fortunes with the name Ford on them. So they are more typical of the U.S. experience of wealth dispersing. And it's true. The Walton family does have a large family foundation. They also have so much money that is not moving into charity. And you have to wonder, why are they sitting on, you know, $160 billion of wealth? What's the plan here?
Well, they also essentially invest in reactionary charity projects, if indeed I can use the word charity, like charter schools.
Yes.
Which
yeah,
seems
John
to be...
Walton is a right. major funder of charter school and privatization of education. So
right. Right.
They're not a benign force. They're a negative force.
Right. So as you point out in your article at The Guardian, Chuck, in the early 2000s, the Mars, the Waltons, and the Gallo families out here in California, Gallo Wine, they actively lobbied to abolish the federal estate tax, which, of course, is largely paid by multimillionaires and billionaires. So that's when that whole idea, they use these think tanks to gin up this idea that all these family farms were going broke because of the estate tax. Is that their work?
Exactly. And I was there. It was really 20 years ago that we started to see these advertisements and this campaign kind of emerging out of nowhere to abolish the death tax. And huge amounts of resources were going into this, and a lot of it was around creating this kind of false misinformation campaign that the estate tax, the death tax, was something that everyone would have to pay, as opposed to the reality, which was only paid by multimillionaires and billionaires. And they were incredibly effective. And when we started to dig into, like, well, who's the money behind this? It were these dynastic wealthy families. It wasn't first-generation entrepreneurs. It was people who were like second- and third-generation wealthy people, like the Gallo Wine family. The Waltons were there. The Mars family was there. Those families were investing in public policy. As we said, they were willing to spend millions to save themselves billions in future taxes.
But at the end of the day, they buy very conservative, usually Republican, congressmen and senators, do they not, to enact these laws?
They use their philanthropic resources. As Jane Mayer pointed out in Dark Money, they figure out how to weaponize philanthropy to advance a very narrow agenda, and they give their money to PACs and political campaigns, and they overall have an enormous influence on democratic institutions. So they were able to almost abolish the estate tax. It was hanging by a thread, and the fact that it's still there, it's been considerably weakened as a tax. So the amount of money it raises, the impact it has on concentrated wealth, is greatly diminished.
But how do they get away with, I understand using as your fronts and feeding the propaganda of death tax to these conservative Republican candidates and officials, but then their job in turn is to pass very unpopular legislation, which is aimed at cutting popular programs like Social Security, Medicare, etc. So that's the amazing part of it, is that these billionaire families are able to advance unpopular inequality, exacerbating highly conservative economic policies. So what does that say about the rest of us? Are we simply not paying attention?
Well, I think that it is. I think most people don't fully understand these dynamics at the very, very high, you know, sort of billionaire level in society, and experience society more as, oh, government can't get anything done that really matters to me. And it's not just passing conservative legislation, it's really blocking anything else. So even though the wider public would like to see the minimum wage higher, they believe that the tax code should be considerably fairer and that the wealthy should pay more. They believe we should have, you know, low tuition or free tuition at higher education institutions, you know, paid for by progressive tax. Even though people want those things, they're essentially blocked by a political system dominated by wealth. And so I think people are feeling cynical, feeling powerless, but at the same time, we should remind ourselves, there's overwhelming popular support for the kinds of things that would reduce these inequalities. And it's really a matter of electing people who are campaigning on those kind of programs, supporting campaigns. You know, there was an effort in California to bring back California's state estate tax and link the money to a college for all. It didn't get the necessary number of signatures to go on the ballot, but that campaign, that movement is still there, and I think we'll see it again. So those are the kind of things that I think could turn this around and could lead to the reversal of these inequalities.
Well, you mentioned Gary Cohn, who said that anybody who pays in estate taxes is a moron. The last thing he got through was that huge tax cuts for the super rich, this so-called middle-class tax cut that the Republicans passed and that Donald Trump claimed was for the middle class. Now, of course, he's come out with a new one saying we have a new tax cut for the middle class, almost a de facto recognition of the fraud of the original tax cut that they passed a little while back. And we now know how catastrophic that's going to be. Already Janet Yellen, the former head of the Fed, is saying deficits are unsustainable. We will have trillion-dollar deficits now for at least the next 4 years because of this giveaway to the super rich under Trump. And guess what they're doing already? Mitch McConnell is saying we're going to have to cut Social Security. So that's their strategy. You give enormous tax cuts to the super wealthy who don't need it. That balloons the deficits because you're not getting the revenues that you normally should be getting. And then that gives you an excuse to cut the so-called entitlement programs for the middle class and the poor. I mean, again, this is just so reactionary and so punitive and so outrageous. This is something you'd expect in the Middle Ages under a feudal system.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, in a way, the so-called starve the beast strategy, we're seeing it laid out here, and you're going to have, oh, well, government spending is rising. Well, actually, government spending hasn't been rising. It hasn't been rising anywhere near as much as deficits caused by tax cuts, but that's going to be the story we hear. What's fascinating is just how few people are falling for it. Most people support tax cuts generally. It's just sort of a reflexive thing. It's like, sure, a tax cut, that sounds great. People didn't support these Trump tax cuts back at a year ago. They understood that they were mostly going to a couple, you know, hundred global corporations and the very rich. They're not good talking points on the campaign trail. They've decided to stop talking about the tax cuts because most people are like, hey, those were for the rich. So they're back to the anti-immigration, you know, talking points. I don't think people are going to fall for the, you know, oh, we need to now cut entitlements because our deficits are so big. There is going to be growing pressure to reverse the Trump tax cuts. That should be the demand, that they're a disastrous mistake, and they should be reversed. And I think there's mounting pressure and awareness that that's what we have to do.
Well, we should call them the Trump and Gary Cohen tax cuts, because Trump, I don't think, knows what he's doing. He doesn't care. He's a total sociopath and a narcissist. But Gary Cohen came across as the reasonable one. Remember, he was the guy that was upset over Trump's coddling the Nazis at Charlottesville. So just in closing, what makes those kind of people tick? We know Trump's a disaster, but Cohen was basically considered one of the adults in the room.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have a theory of how the economy's going to grow and how tax cuts are part of that. And there's also just plain old donor payback. I mean, you know, the Sheldon Adelsons of the world said, I'm never going to give any money to Republicans again if you can't get this tax cut passed. And mm-hmm. other major donors, that is their top priority. They want to pay less taxes. They want to build these wealth dynasties. They want to pass on unlimited inheritances to their children and grandchildren. They want the power that goes along with that, and they're using their power. Mm-hmm. And this tax cut from a year ago was really the payback. And but it's fundamentally anti-democratic. It fundamentally undermines, you know, our voices, everybody else's voices in the economy. And it's time to obviously push back.
Right. And every rich kid that I've ever met in my life, Chuck, has been screwed up. So these are the ones that are inheriting the earth, right? Go figure.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Chuck Collins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and co-edits inequality.org. He's the author of Born on Third Base, a 1%er makes the case for tackling inequality, and Is Inequality in America Irreversible? And he is the co-author of a new report at inequality.org, Billionaire Bonanza 2018, The Role of Dynastic Wealth. And his latest article at The Guardian is The Wealth of America's Three Richest Families Grew by 6,000% since 1982. And that was Chuck Collins from October of 2018, talking about a 6,000% increase in dynastic wealth of the Waltons, Mars, and Koch families since 1982. We're going to take a brief station break, and on this New Year's Eve, we'll be joined by Yochai Benkler talking about Trump's propagandist in chief, Fox News. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Yochai Benkler, who is the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and faculty co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. And he is the co-author of the new book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yochai Benkler.
Glad to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And today, at a very combative press conference, President Trump was very angry and insulting towards one particular member of the media from CNN. But in general, his tone was quite hostile. He was asked a question about what he should do about social media in terms of policing content. And he cited the First Amendment and said he was a huge believer in the First Amendment and thought that that probably meant he wouldn't do anything, or at least approach it cautiously. But my sense about these new platforms and their enormous importance and influence, like Facebook, for example, isn't the problem the platforms themselves?
So I think our research actually pushes back to some extent. Not that there's nothing wrong with the platforms, because what we find, but that at least when you're looking at American politics, television is much more important, talk radio is not less important, and a lot of the most destructive disinformation is not the result of platform algorithms, but the result of a sustained campaign on one side. And on the other, long-term competitive dynamics in the right-wing media ecosystem that practically force anybody operating in that market to just ramp it up to the sharpest, most extreme versions of self-reinforcing stories. So it's just a lot less about, at least if you look at the United States, it's a lot less about the digital, the platforms, and a lot more about the political culture and the media ecosystem on the right.
And there is, as you point out in your new book, a kind of asymmetry here, is there not? That on the right, even though liberals and conservatives are arguably both in separate bubbles, and there is no consensus in this country anymore about what is true and what is real. If you, for example, go back to the days of Walter Cronkite there, on the evening news, Uncle Walter seemed to be believed by most Americans. Now, those days are over. But there is a tendency, and I've fallen into that tendency myself, to equate Fox and MSNBC by saying, well, conservatives get their information from Fox and liberals from MSNBC. But at least on MSNBC, they do practice journalism. And I think it's important that you have pointed that out.
So our observations really come out of the data. We analyzed millions, I mean literally 4 million political stories from 2015 to 2018. And we analyzed the data on multiple dimensions. We looked at what online news sites link to, so how media producers link to each other, which the platforms have nothing to do with. We looked at Twitter. We looked at Facebook. We used text itself and the similarity of text. Again and again, what comes back when we use different platforms, when we use different measures, and when we use different techniques, what always comes back is that you have a stark and insular right-wing media ecosystem anchored in Fox and in Breitbart, where the entire dynamic is to reinforce the set of partisan beliefs, police anyone, whether it's a politician or a media outlet, that steps out of line, and compete between the major sites having the least extreme versions, and then sites competing and differentiating themselves on just how extreme the rhetoric they can throw is. There is no such thing on the left. Essentially, if you go all the way from the, let's call it, center-right Wall Street Journal or Forbes, all the way to the left, it's not that you don't see partisan outlets. You absolutely see partisan outlets. But they're all part of a single media ecosystem. And we see when we look at audiences based on Twitter, based on Facebook, the audience also spreads its attention much more broadly. People seem to be looking at a more diverse range of outlets, some in the center, some in the center left, some in the left. And this structure, both of audience behavior and of outlet behavior, forces everyone to be more measured, to be more anchored in reality. There's real competition between the outlets to criticize each other if they get it wrong. There's real competition to come out first with the story, but also to come out first with the debunking. And that dynamic in the much more diverse and ideologically broader media ecosystem on the left means that it operates much more anchored in reality and less stoking of extremism. There is some extremism in very specific outlets. It's not that you don't see disinformation and very sharpened views. But overall, when you look at the population, these sites play a much more peripheral role, whereas on the right, they really are the center of the media ecosystem.
And again, I'm speaking with Yochai Benkler, who is the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and faculty co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He's the co-author of the new book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. And your new book refutes, to some extent, the conventional wisdom about how much Russian manipulation in the 2016 elections was effective. It's not to say it didn't happen, but its effects have been exaggerated. And you also suggest that the micro-targeting by Cambridge Analytica, its effect has also been exaggerated. But that's not to say that in effect, Fox News and Trump himself are examples of the success of what Vladislav Surkov brought to the table in Russia. The new term, of course, for people like Vladislav Surkov, a former theater director, is a political technologist. And he taught Putin how to manipulate reality and turn politics into theater. And we have a reality TV star in the Oval Office, and he and Fox News certainly do that. I mean, you saw Hannity on stage with him just the other night. The loop is complete, shall we say, with Bill Shine, the protege of Roger Ailes, who started Fox News, now as the White House communications director.
Absolutely. Every piece of that, in my view, is right. In other words, absolutely, when we looked for Russians, we found them. They're there. They're trying. And for people who are concerned with the legitimacy of the election, there's no question that for a foreign power like this to intervene in American politics in the way that they did is illegal. And for someone to collaborate with them, actually in terms of conspiring to perform illegal acts like hacking, is also illegal. Not that the U.S. did not intervene and doesn't intervene in other countries clandestinely, but let's put that aside. The point is not whether they were trying or whether what they did was illegal, but did it have an impact? And when we actually dig in deeply into the concrete allegations of how the Russians influenced the election, and we study all of the email, all of the stories about the emails, and the specific crazy conspiracy theories that came out of one or the other, consistently we see the Russians essentially jumping on the bandwagon of things that were already pushed on the right, leaning into themes that were already there, and in many senses being relatively peripheral. So if you spend a few $100,000 doing targeted advertising to suppress the vote, and you know that the campaign, that the Trump campaign itself spent millions doing the same thing, it's very hard to suddenly say that was exactly the incremental additional piece. And the same is true with regard to Cambridge Analytica, which seemed to be more hype from the company itself. But the core point you're making, which is that the strategy that emerges in the middle of the first decade of the 20th century in Russia, but really ramps up with Putin around after 2012 when he comes back, of continuously confusing everyone and making the entire project of understanding what's going on in the world being more a piece of entertainment, and essentially everyone doubts everything and nothing is true, that's a remarkably effective tool for authoritarians, because if everything is true or everything is untrue, then the authoritarian leader can essentially get away with everything. And this is absolutely central to the strategy we see now with Trump, rolling out one outrage after another, things that are completely impossible, like we'll give a tax break while Congress is not in session. One flows after the other. The caravan is showing up. Some of them are specifically tailored to incite. Others are just confusing. That state of affairs, where you have a whole population that simply doesn't know where to look in order to find what's true and not, makes it much easier for an authoritarian figure like Trump to get away with anything, because everything is possible. Nothing is true. You do whatever you want, and no one can hold you to account because no one knows what's going on. Enormously dangerous.
So then that leads me to the question about who is enabling this, and that has to be Rupert Murdoch. And you have to ask yourself, what is going on here? Apparently Murdoch is very much a mentor of Trump, talks to him regularly, if not every day, on the phone. And then he hangs up the phone and says, what a bloody idiot, you know. And then he's also the literally the matchmaker who put Ivanka and Jared Kushner together. So obviously there's a connection there. But why is Murdoch doing this, do you think? Is it power? What explains that cynicism?
So I'd rather not speculate because this isn't something I know from my research, and I really avoid doing that. I don't know what drives Murdoch. It's obviously a fantastic business model, and it's been an enormous success for Fox News. It may well be primarily a political ploy, but I think it's important not to focus, at least for me, not to focus on the individual agency, this terrible evil genius or that terrible evil character, but rather to look at the structure of the problem, which is to say, before Murdoch, there was already Limbaugh. Alongside Fox, there's already Clear Channel buying up hundreds of radio stations, buying Premier Radio, the producer of all of the major talk radio shows, and programming coast to coast, 24 hours a day, bile and hatred from Limbaugh, from Glenn Beck, from Sean Hannity as well. So you're getting, these are not Murdoch, but they're doing the same thing. Breitbart, this is again, Mercer-funded, Bannon-led, also not Murdoch. What's important in this regard to understand is that the structure of the network, the way in which these actors have learned how to make a lot of money from using the fact that the Republican Party drew in as part of its base both strong white identity voters and strong religious voters, each of which for its own purposes is disconnected from, let's call it, mainstream professional judgments of how you get things right and wrong. And then uses this market segmentation to make big business out of telling people what they want to hear and giving them their daily shot of bile, anger, outrage, the sense of shared identity from hating someone else. It's that big business of selling outrage, selling hatred, selling affirmation and membership to this audience that's much more important to my mind than any single individual who is a large player in this market.
Well, in terms of the audiences for the liberal and conservative media, it's pretty clear that liberals want facts and conservatives want their biases reinforced, and that's certainly what Limbaugh and company do. And to my mind, you know, there's not a great deal of difference between the profession of journalism and being an intelligence officer, in the sense that you're supposed to be skeptical, you're supposed to be inquiring, you're not supposed to be gullible, you're not supposed to believe propaganda and the first thing that people in power tell you. That is the antithesis. And that, frankly, I think is a more traditional or useful definition of what liberal means, to be skeptical as opposed to be gullible. But how do you operate in an environment where to Donald Trump, the truth is irrelevant, but to journalism, the truth is everything? So you've got the president saying the press is the enemy of the people, when it's very much more likely that the truth is the enemy of Donald Trump.
Well, I think that the core diagnosis of the press is the enemy of the people only if the truth is the enemy of Donald Trump gets it just right. When you ask what do you do, I think as long as it appears to be the case, and this might change over time, but as long as it appears to be the case that there's a good 15 to 25% of the population who do vote Republican, who do lean Republican, who do sometimes watch Fox News, but are not 100% in that echo chamber. They do also watch a lot of local news. They do also watch a lot of network news. They watch some CNN. They mostly, it's less reading newspapers, actually, and the relatively older audiences, so not so much online. That audience becomes really important to educate and to help remember this ideal of a moment of Walter Cronkite, as you describe it, even though when we look at it in hindsight, we understand that that was a deeply problematic dynamic, excluding views not only on the right but also on the left, having a very patriarchal view often, excluding views of minorities. It's not as though we actually believe that in the myth of the Walter Cronkite era anymore for anyone. It's complicated. But continuing to insist on the importance, not falling for really now everything is just a bias confirmation, so we have to move for that. Being very explicit to audiences about what's going on and not falling for traps. One of the classic, there's tremendous media activism, if you want to think of it in this way, going on, both from Trump and from right-wing media, that makes it very hard for mainstream media to just leave things alone. So in the campaign, it was the Clinton emails and the Clinton Foundation. This last midterm, it was the caravan. It was the sudden decision that he can get rid of birthright citizenship. Each of these, essentially, you throw a flame into the fire, and it's very hard for traditional journalists to contain themselves and not cover, because it's so outrageous. It draws audiences. Mm-hmm. And so it will require a lot of self-discipline from editors and journalists about how to curate, what to cover, how not to cover, how little to cover something that's unimportant, even if the president is talking about it a lot. That's not easy, and that's a completely different way of thinking about journalism when you're in the presence of such highly asymmetric and cynical propagandism than it was when everybody was more or less in the same universe of what it meant to have facts, not to have facts, to try to investigate them, not to investigate them. So I think that's the big challenge of journalism today. It's far from solved, but I think as soon as journalists and editors recognize that this is the great challenge in the teeth of propaganda, they can at least start to be more thoughtful, more conscious, and more constructive.
Well, Yehoi Bankler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise. I'm very grateful for this conversation. And again, I've been speaking with Yehoi Bankler, who is the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and faculty co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He's the co-author of the new book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. We can take a brief station break. We're back looking into the election results in both the House and Senate in the context of the structural disadvantages Democrats have going into the future. And you've been listening to Yehoi Bankler talking about Trump's propagandist-in-chief, Fox News. And, of course, without Fox, Donald Trump would be a distant memory. And we'll have more of our retrospective of 2018 tomorrow. But in the meantime, I wish you all a very happy new year. The lady dressed in white with a man she loved.